You know, I once thought that coming to Ananda, in the world, you seek to have everything money can buy. At Ananda, you seek to have everything that money can't buy. And that's a much, much more valuable treasure than the other way around. So we're talking, as we have been, about the history of Ananda. And I'll introduce our panel. I'm going to talk primarily about Ananda House, which was the first of the big urban communities. But more than that, the movement, the expansion of Ananda away from being village-centric, which it was at that time. Prakash is going to talk about the apprenticeship program through which many, many people came to Ananda in the early days. Nitai will talk about the schools. Bharat will talk about sharing nature. Durga will talk about the establishment of the expanding light and of Ocean Song, another community that we had. And Devi will talk about everything the rest of us missed. So Ananda House, what we're talking about here, it's hard to have it in distinct little years because the creation of a community and the movement of energy outward is a continuing process. It isn't just you do this one year and then you go on and you do this the next year. But obviously the schools were here for a long time, but there were greater expressions of them. And so we're going to, each of us, attempt to kind of tell our story inside of about 15 minutes, which won't be easy because there's a lot to tell. So the establishment of Ananda House was in San Francisco. So actually the roots of the work in San Francisco go back to the very beginning. You know, one could really say that the communities movement, Ananda communities movement, started with Swami's connection with Master and especially with that great talk that Master gave at the garden party in Beverly Hills. And Swami was fired at that time with the desire to create these communities. And then after his dismissal from SRF, he went to his parents' house in Atherton, which is close to Palo Alto. And after a couple of years of reestablishing himself, then he moved to San Francisco. And so by about 1964 or so, he was living in San Francisco and in a little two-bedroom apartment and starting to do the expansion of Master's work again. He was teaching classes. He was corresponding with people. He was establishing things. And in 66, he came and visited the land that is the meditation retreat. And visiting there, he felt Master's and the blessings of this line of gurus on that property in a very strong and tangible way. And so he bought that land. Just about that time is when I met him and then quickly became his assistant in San Francisco. And so in April of 69, both of us moved to Ananda, to the meditation retreat. And very shortly after that, we were, by necessity, had to get the property here because we couldn't build houses, we couldn't really have families at the site at the meditation retreat. So the establishment, there's an establishment of a pattern that is going on here that's very, very important because it has followed through for basically, Ananda is almost 50 years old now. If you take the purchase of the first property, I'm not sure the exact date of that, but that's 50 years ago. And so Ananda's has a fairly long history, but there are some patterns that have been established, and those patterns were carried through to the expansion of the work. And that's more what I want to talk about. It's fun to talk about stories of a particular place and a particular time, but I'm more interested in kind of the philosophical overview of it. What was really happening? Why were those stories taking place? What was going on? And what are the ramifications that are going to go into the future? And so, obviously, the first thing that happened was the establishment of communities. And Master talked about that very, very strongly, because he said that if people are going to seek God, it's much better to do that within a group, because you support each other. Support each other in your most important quests, support each other socially, support each other psychologically, but of course, most importantly, support each other spiritually. And so the way Master described that is home, job, and church in one place. An integrated, completely integrated life where there isn't the disconnect that we see in societies around. So Swami came with that mission, and all of us who came in the early years came to support that. Looking back, it just looks like things happen. You know, this week happens, and then next week, and then next month, and this job and that job. But looking back, you can see that there's a pattern in all of this. So I came with Swamiji, and partly because of that, partly because of karma, I became the village manager for the first 10 years until we moved to San Francisco, which is going to be the essence of that, of what I'm talking about. But the fact that I was the manager here is relatively important. The fact that we came, basically all of us who are talking today came within the first 5 or 6 years of the community starting. So we were all pioneers. And that pioneering effort then that was established here then was replicated, but replicated in the proper way as we went out farther. So home, job, and church at Ananda Village looks like one thing. Home, job, and church in the middle of San Francisco looks like something else. In Italy, it's slightly different. In India, it's different yet. And yet that basic thrust is still there. And so the story of San Francisco, I lived in San Francisco when I met Swami for about 2 or 2.5 years. And then in 1979, so this would be roughly 10 years after the establishment of the village here, and the first 67, 68, we were really just barely getting our roots established, getting the land and the first buildings, but no permanent population. So 1969 is when the permanent population here started. And then in 10 years later, in 1979, Swami decided during the summer of 79 that he wanted to go down and do programs in San Francisco. I don't remember that he said specifically that he intended to start a community there. The year earlier, there had been a very small attempt. Hari Das and Vijay went to Sacramento, but it was just the two of them in a little house. But it was the establishment of Ananda, the idea that Ananda is not located in a place, but is a movement that is a portable paradise that can be taken into different environments. So that was the very first start, but it was just a tiny little seed. San Francisco in the spring of 1979, April or so, Swami went down and he asked a few people to go down with him to San Francisco because, as we understood, he was going to be giving some programs and wanted a support staff there. And so we moved down at first into a little three-bedroom house. Swami had, from the days of the outreach after the fire, you know, he did this cross-country tour, the Joy Tours. At that time, he got a big motor home. And so he was living in the motor home outside of this little two-bedroom, three-bedroom place in San Francisco. And there were 9 or 10 of us packed in there. Davy and I, by this time, had a son who was 2.5 years old. We lived in one of the bedrooms, and it had a walk-in closet that was much too big to put clothes in, so another person lived in the walk-in closet. Santosh, for those of you who know him. So it was a little tight in there. One morning, after Davy and I had had one of those discussions that couples sometimes have, Santosh came out of the walk-in closet, and he said, "Oh, I slept like a log. I didn't hear a thing." And so we were really, really tightly packed in there. During the week, Swami was giving these programs at a Unitarian church, and it was a different format than he had ever done before, something we'd never seen. He would talk a little bit, but then he would have the audience talk. And each week he would give it would be a little bit like the From Affirmations book. You know, there's a theme each week. So he'd give a little talk on that theme. And then he would give a homework assignment to everybody in the audience to practice and then come back the next week and report on what they had done, what the insights. And so people were coming. It got to be 30, 40, 50 people would come to those satsangs. But it was involving people much more than just lecturing to people. Then after a few months, there was a little interim period where the house just got too crowded, and Swami and Davy and I lived right near the ocean in San Francisco in a little apartment. But in the late summer, there's something in San Francisco called the Designer Showcase, and they take a big house and maybe 20 different designers come into that place, and they decorate a room or a dining room or a bedroom in a particular style. Then hundreds of people come by, and it's a fun event. But obviously, they find the biggest house that they can find that's available in order to do that. So here we had been in a 2-3-bedroom house. We moved to a little apartment, but we needed more space. Davy and I never knew that we were supposed to be staying there. We went down for a weekend. Swami asked us to stay on. People were bringing our clothes down in black garbage bags to us, you know. And here we were with a family setting up a new situation there. At any rate, at the end of this designer's showcase, one of the people who had been coming said, "You know, there's an in," because by then we were looking for a bigger place, but we were thinking 4 bedrooms, 6 bedrooms. Someone said, "You know, there's this place available. Maybe you ought to come and see it." And so we went and saw it. It was a mansion in the ritziest part of San Francisco, less than a block away from the house that they shot Mrs. Doubtfire. You know that? It had the best view of the bay all the way around. People would come and sit on the corner. We were one house from the corner. They would sit on the corner because it had one of the best views in San Francisco. 44-room mansion. And so we walked in, just kind of an absurd experiment. And Swami looks around and he says, "This feels like ours." And so we gathered together the people who were a little bit involved on a continuing basis and talked about, can we do this? You know, I think we moved from $500 a month rent to $10,000, $3,000, Davey says, but the $4,500. And in those days, yeah, Davey had to pay the bills. I was more comfortable in my teepee than in this mansion. At any rate, so this got established, and that became a place that people lived. So about 30 people lived there together. Many, many people who are still here as part of Ananda, that was their first exposure, first place they lived together. But we started the establishment in an urban setting of home, job, and place, a home, job, and church in one place. So at first we actually taught inside the house until the building permits or planning, whatever, the county booted San Francisco said that was illegal. Then we had to find another place that was, you know, like the church. We established a restaurant and a bookstore. Again, the pattern that was going to be replicated. So a bookstore and a restaurant was established, 30 people living together. But there was another pattern that happened there that continued in, and I just realized this in meditating this morning, that that was also the establishment of something that's going to be important in the future of Ananda and Dwapara Yuga, and that's that a couple together were the head of what could be considered an ashram or a community. Davey and I are part of what's called the speaking tree in India, and they have a website with what they call masters, which are teachers, and they have about 125 or 150. Davey and I are the only couple out of 150. If you look around, there's no, except for Ananda, there's no model where a couple and householders together lead a spiritual work. And it's not that Davey and I are important in that. It's that in Dwapara Yuga, there's going to be a rebalancing of the male and female energy. The fact that we teach together, that we lead things together, that we're householders, that we have a family, is an important model because that establishes true community as opposed to just ashram. And so this pattern then has been replicated, and it's going to be replicated into the long future. I don't have much time to talk about it, but I want to end by saying that now Ananda is established, obviously, in this country, in Washington, in Seattle, Portland, Sacramento, Palo Alto, here in the village, which is a little different because it's rural. We're establishing in LA. We will end up with a community there. And then we have centers and meditation groups, but we also have now Assisi, and the model is persisting there, and India, and the model will persist there. But see, that energy that Master put out in 1948, that is like a huge wave that is reaching out, and it's almost as if there was a blueprint in the ether as he talked about it, but it isn't an actual blueprint. It's an energy vibration. And that energy vibration includes an integrated life, integration of the male and female energy, integration of families, but most important, the core of living together for God, with each other, people who are seeking God, and that that is not location-based, but rather vibrationally based. And so that pattern now has gone out through the rest of the world. I'd like now to invite Prakash.
So I got here in 1974, in early August, and within a few months, someone asked me to run the apprentice program. Apprentice program. And before I came to Ananda, I'd had a feeling about apprenticeship. I think it was my medieval lifetimes. I always loved the idea of the guilds and learning a skill that one could use in life and following a master. I was absolutely entranced with a man in England who spent his whole life repairing grandfather clocks. And I just thought it would be heaven to be a disciple to such a person. And so when I was asked to do the apprentice program, it threw me back to my first experience reading the autobiography, because the desire had risen in me to serve the master and to serve something larger than myself. And there was the idea of community. It was very vague. There was no model for it in Louisville, Kentucky, but it was there. And so I'd been here a couple of months, and I don't know who, but someone said, "You'll do the apprentice program." And there was an apprentice program. It was gardeners. It was Shivani. And they would take a group of people, I think at 7 in the morning, down to the garden, and they would do gardening things. And then they'd come back up and live at the retreat. So I thought, well, that sounds like a good idea. So it was winter, and I asked someone what you did about a program, and they said, well, you put out little notices to tell people that you're having a program, and then people will come. And so I made some little blurbs, and they said something like, Ananda Apprentice Program, Yoga and Meditation, Apprenticeships in Garden, Dairy, Cooking, Carpentry, I forget, different things. And sent it off to, I think, East West Magazine, Yoga Journal, and Communities Magazine. Just a little square thing like you'd see in the classifieds. And people started to write. And of course, I'd written it out, you know, with my ballpoint pen, like I do still. And people came. So while this was all happening, I was at the meditation retreat, and I was, of course, on my spiritual honeymoon. And I was being influenced by the mighty Shivani on one side with her Gita class, in which she gave us wise advice with her tremendous energy. And so one of the things she said was, it's a good idea to pick a spiritual quality and stay with it for a year. And she said, I personally like to go through the yamas and niyamas, and I forget which one she was on, but she'd been doing this for a while, and we just got there, you know. So, and then she also talked about journaling and how you could have this conversation with God and be working on this quality, and your life would. So this was going on, and then when I got to the monastery, there was Haridas and Binay, who had the Future Saints Club, and they urged us to be awake and ready at all times, and to memorize the Maha affirmation, the affirmation for psychological success. So I thought, ahimsa. And then parts of that affirmation pertain to anything you want to be doing. So I was going around in my mind going, I am sweet, I am kind, I am love and sympathy. I have no enemy, I am the friend of all. That's a section that sort of was, thank you. That was going on. So then the apprentice, some people showed up for the apprentice program. And I'll back up just a little bit. So during that year, the other major influence was, of course, and the most important one was the 14 steps. I love the 14 steps. I think they were called the 14 steps of self-mastery. And Devi was handing them out, and she would send me one when she felt I was ready for it. I believe I asked about this because they didn't come every 2 weeks. As I, and she said, well, when I intuit that you're ready or something like that, then I send you one. And it was true. They arrived perfectly. So anyway, that was the 14 steps. And when I got into the 14 steps, I was convinced that the 14 steps would save humanity. They were the most wonderful thing I'd ever seen. And when I was back in Kentucky and I'd read the autobiography, it said nothing about what to do. And I wrote SRF, and they wouldn't send me the lessons. They didn't, I don't know. Master didn't want me to be involved in that. But when I got the 14 steps, these were actual lessons that told me what to do about everything. It was all there. And so I would go up every weekend to Bald Mountain and squirrel myself away and just immerse myself in them. They were wonderful. It was a little tilty out there, so the postures were a bit of a challenge. And I would always wake up in the bottom of my tent because everything was downhill, sort of wadded up. But it was a very beautiful, blissful time. And Satya was doing all the sadhanas then. And so I went to all his sadhanas. He had some unique ways of doing the energization, I found out later. But it was close enough. He taught me all the techniques. And then he informed me that he was leaving for 2 weeks and I would be leading all the sadhanas. And so I applied my years of being a student to memorizing the affirmations and so on. And so there it all was. And then the apprentice program started. So 12 people showed up in the beginning of May. It was going to run May through October. And they showed up and it snowed. And they were in their little tents. And we were, of course, I get my years mixed up. So anyway, I think this is my memory of the beginning. So there we were. There was a farmhouse down at the entryway. It was a yellow farmhouse of what was here before. It's a farmhouse with a breezeway, a little covered, and then a little garage. And that was the apprentice village. There we were. And you can see where it was. You can see the vinca and the St. John's wort growing down there and those sycamore trees. That was the landscaping. And so there was the house, like a lot of farmhouses, they would put river rocks down, and then they put a post on it, and then they'd build a house. So it's a wetland down there, so everything kind of settled, and so there were no straight lines or level surfaces or vertical surfaces in the building. And so our sadhanas were interesting. We had a pose. I used to call it the leaping tree pose, and people would be flying across the room trying to keep their balance. So we stopped doing it in the morning. The afternoon was better. But I remember that first it was the orientation, and I'd never taught a class in my life, and except for the yoga postures. And there they all were, and it was really cold, and there was no central heating. There was a fireplace at one end of what had been the living room, little boxy room down there. And so I was wedged up in one corner. I thought I should be, you know, one end of the room, and the students would be at the other end of the room. And they were wadded in a tight knot right in front of the fireplace with had this pitiful little fire in it. And if you know, if you've ever been in a home heated by fireplaces, they don't, the heat, if you're right there, you can get cooked on one side, but but everything else is freezing. And then, of course, they were all jammed in there so that the ones in front. So I was facing this little knot of people who were glowering at me accusingly. So anyway, we got through that. And it warmed up. So I was practicing ahimsa, as I mentioned. And it seemed to me that the way to run an apprentice program was to be in a state of ahimsa. So whenever someone would come, I had a little office upstairs. That was my little room. And my idea of running the program was to whenever someone would come in, I'd get them up, I'd give them a foot rub, and I would talk to them, or they'd talk to me, and I'd say encouraging things. And then they go on about their business. And then the next one would come up. So this went on all day long. And seemed like a great idea. This year was called the Summer of Love. And so I was practicing ahimsa as I was. I realized that what was mostly preventing me from practicing ahimsa was all this eating and digesting and so on, all those processes. So I found if I would cut that way back, my spirits would soar, my meditation would be deeper, and I'd feel very kindly toward everyone. So I kept on with this. Purushottama and Kirtani would bring me these jugs of apple juice, which I eventually became too weak to even lift. But by maintaining this diet and working with everyone this way, I felt constantly loving toward all people. And I was gradually disappearing on the physical plane. I remember my favorite story about that year, which I was, because I was always upstairs in my little cubbyhole, I missed most of what was going on. But my favorite was that I think Purushottama told me this one, that there was the Lotus Lake was really just a pond at the time. And there were a lot of healing modalities going on at the time. And he said that one of the fellows, I guess, took all his clothes off and packed himself in mud, completely encased himself in mud, and then fell asleep. And when he woke up, he'd set up, and he was unable to move. And so he said he kind of scrunched his way down into the water where it eventually dissolved. And he was able to proceed. Then there was our dietary process. And I should mention, I had one staff member, whose name I won't mention, who was stolen from me by Nitai. And one staff member, and she was gone after a day. And then after that, we had no staff. It was just me upstairs doing what I was doing. And we were just all making do. So different people would take over the kitchen, and meals were prepared. I wasn't much interested in what that was all about. But meals happened, and we eventually found out that things were getting a little askew because Parvati was running the market and mentioned that one week this enormous quantity of fruit had been purchased. And then the next week it was all rice. And so what had happened was for a week we had a fruitarian diet, and then we had a macrobiotic diet the next week. And so it just went according to whoever was there. So we reined that in a little bit. So this year came to a close, and we were all very loving. Oh, it was a bit, that was the other thing. Our sanitation was poor. I had decided at one point that we should kill nothing. And because of our fluid cooking arrangement, there were some flies around, and I felt that we should overcome fly consciousness. So I refused to injure the flies, and I actually got to a point where they wouldn't land on me when I'd meditate. But this was not the case for the others. And so there was that to deal with. So we got through the first year, and Swami, in his gentle way, looked at me and said, "You look better when you weigh," and then he named a figure that was 70 pounds higher than my current weight. And then I also heard through someone else that he had not been happy when he'd gone there because, as he put it, seemed that no one was in charge. And so this became my mantra: be in charge. I'm going to be in charge. So I started eating, and within 2 months, I gained 50 pounds, and then the body just refused to gain any more. And I went to work in construction. We were building things, and I was being a carpenter. And so the second year of the program started. This is the one that's known as the year of discipline. And since I was no longer allowed to try to achieve my spiritual goals through dietary means, I decided to just use straight willpower. So the first step was to conquer sleep. And so I would get up at 1 o'clock in the morning, and I would energize, and then I'd put on my leather work boots, and I would run over to the apprentice village. The monastery was right below Swami's, where the goats are now sometimes. And so I'd run over in my boots, and I would arrive 1:30 or something, 1:45. And then I would energize again. I would do Maha Mudra for an hour. I'd do Kriya for an hour. And then it would be, by then it would be 4 o'clock and time to ring the bell and get everybody up. And I'd been up for hours. So I would go out, and we had a tripod out in the meadow here. There was no buildings. There was no real road. I guess there was kind of a dirt track that wound up the hill where the road is now. And I would go out and ring this. It was an oxygen tank, and you thump it. And then people would gather in the colder weather down the farmhouse. But in the summer, by the time I'd really gotten into my sleep battle, we were up here in the meadow. So I'd ring the bell, and the apprentices would come, and they would gather out in the meadow. And we would have our yoga postures and energization and so on. So I would lead them through that, and then we'd sit to meditate, and I would immediately fall asleep because I was so sleep-deprived. So I kept this up. And I heard from Bharat that one of our long-term members mentioned to him that said, I was so surprised when I found out that not everyone in the community got up at 4 to do their sadhana. It was just us apprentices. And so we went along in this way. And I had a staff. Now, I'd been given a staff. One member of staff had been assigned to me to kind of guard the gate because some of the people I was letting in to be apprentices were, let's say, odd. Odd. And two, even more odd than what our community could handle. And as I said, I thought Master's teachings would heal everybody. Just get them studying the 14 steps and be in the Ananda vibration and around Swami's energy. I mean, it was all right here. The 50% of God's grace was just being at Ananda, in my feeling. And the 25% of the guru's help on your behalf was, we had a direct link through Swami. And the 25% of personal effort was the 14 steps. And so we had this procedure going on, and my guard dog person and another fellow who was leading some sadhanas, and he was leading Iyengar yoga, which I was discussing with him. I was wanting to have more Swami's yoga, but anyway, that was happening. So they got together, and they conferred with the apprentices, and they organized a mutiny. This is a great moment in the history of the apprentice program. And I'm not sure who did what, but I suppose we had a lot. By this time, the fire had happened. The whole place had burned down, and there we were. So I think there were a lot of old clothes around from gifts people gave us. And so they gathered up a whole lot of clothes, and they taped the bell to one of the legs of the tripod with clothes wrapped around it. And then clothes wrapped around each of the legs and a whole lot more duct tape. And it was all sort of wadded up. So I arrived to do my bell ringing at 4 a.m., as usual. And there it was, right here in the meadow. So I did know that the kitchen contained a butcher knife. So I went down to the kitchen and got the knife and came back and freed the bell. And then started ringing it. And I rang it continuously until everyone showed up. And it was an interesting moment. And so after we completed our sadhana, I went over to see Swami, which I never do. And I said, Swami, is there anything that you'd like me to do differently in the apprentice program? And I always assumed Swami knew everything. And he said, no, it's all right. and sent me about my business. So we had this meeting, and I said, if anyone wants to leave, that's okay. We'll give you your money back. It'll be fine. And I was just, I just felt like Swami gave his blessing, so we're going ahead. And I just looked around at them, and no one said a word. And I realized, thinking, looking back on it, I realized I wouldn't have said a word either, this guy. So, so only one couple left, gave them their money back, and then we proceeded. And I remember stepping outside, and there was a couple there, and she said, well, it's not the discipline I mind, it's the attitude you have of being a drill sergeant. And so that was the term that stayed. And I remember that as a year of massively muscular men, almost all. And then we had two Southern ladies in this mix. It was very odd. And at one point, we had 80 apprentices out there, just sort of a swarm covering the meadow. And so we got through that year. And we'd have these circle meetings in the dome at the meditation retreat, and we would give reports. And then we'd hear feedback from our guru bhais. And so the feedback this year, feedback the previous year was, we need discipline. And the feedback this year was, we need moderation. And so I think it was the next year, Jeannie showed up, Jeannie Shantz, and we had moderation. Moderation and balance appeared in the form of this amazing soul. And she had, we even had one, this person who was unhappy with the program was attempting to chop down the power pole down by the farmhouse with an axe. And Jeannie, instead of becoming upset, got everybody in the garage, which was the temple in that time of the year, and they all chanted Om and prayed for the guy. And the pole still stands, so I guess it worked. So that was the, finally it came into balance in that year. And then the next year, we started the sort of a blend of, as my dream had always been, the 14 steps, that people would stay here long enough to go all the way through the 14 steps and receive all the benefit. So the next year, we expanded the apprentice program into half apprentices and half this sort of blend of apprenticeship and yoga teacher training course that would go on for 3 months. And they would do their apprenticeship. They'd learn a skill that they could earn a living with, and they would study these teachings half the day. So that was where it all concluded. And I just have been so impressed with what Trimurti and others have done with the experience Ananda and the living discipleship, and the Karma Yoga program is the real successor to all this, and it's brought it to a beautiful conclusion. So.
So my name's Nitai. Before I talk about the school, just sitting here, there's it draws up a lot of memories, of course. And what the memory was, Prakash, I remember that Swami had asked me to be in charge of the monks. I just remember this incredible collection of characters that there was absolutely no hope of directing in any particular way. Everybody was so strong-willed. You get to see Bharat after me. He was another one of the characters. But also remember when Jyotish was talking, Jyotish is just such a natural philosopher. And when I came, we had just started the village council, and I got elected to be on the village council, and Jyotish was in charge of that. And so we would have these meetings fairly regularly. I don't remember how often, but at least a couple of times a month. And we had no money to spend, zero. Like the budget was non-existent. So it's really hard to make big decisions when you have no money to work with. But issues would come up, mundane issues like dogs or just different things came up. And I just loved it because Jyotish would always talk about the topic, and he would come at it from this just like he did this morning, in a very, looking at all of different parameters and stuff. And I was part of my education on the spiritual path, which I always really appreciated. So my work was with children. I had read Autobiography of a Yogi in 1969, and just was just touched by the idea of this school in Ranchi, and that I'd never been interested in being a teacher before because it never made any sense to me. But all of a sudden, this whole idea that you could actually inspire children and prepare them for life just kind of struck a chord. I didn't know what to do with it. But when I came up here to visit in 1970, there was the beginning of the community at that point. There was a bunch of kids running around raising ruckus. And something just said, work with this. So I ended up going off to get a teaching credential it took me a couple of years, and I came back. And we were able to launch into this. So I think one of the things I wanted to share was just how it was working with Swami. So I went over to Swami's house to ask him. I said, well, what do you think a spiritual school could be? I said, I'm just kind of trying to learn it. And he says, well, good. I'm glad you should try. And I said, well, what about if I went out and got some other kind of training? Like I could study Waldorf education or Montessori education, or maybe I could go to Ranchi. And the first thing he said, well, there's nothing to learn in Ranchi. And that's all he said. And it was a few years later, I got to go and find out that things had dissolved there, basically. But his response to me was, you have to learn Nitai, you have to learn to look inside for your answers. And that was a foreign concept to me at that point. I didn't really know what he meant by it, to look inside, because it had never been part of any of the training I'd had in my life up to that point. It was always study a book or do some research or talk to somebody else. But the idea of going inside was unusual. And then the other part of it is that he wouldn't say anything. He wouldn't say anything outwardly to me. I later found out that was kind of part, like Prakash was describing. He wanted you to try something, and then he might comment on it and shape it. But until you actually put out some energy, he wasn't going to get involved. So I started trying to figure out what that was. And he hadn't really said much at all for, it was a couple of years. I forget. We were probably in our second year. And then I had this very iconic moment that happened, which shaped me and the school for ever since. Because it was like, how do you share spirituality with children? You know, when I grew up, it was like I memorized a bunch of questions and answers. And if you could spit back the questions, you were being trained spiritually. And that never made any sense to me at all. I used to get A's in religion, but I think I was an atheist in the class because it didn't make any sense. But so I didn't want to go that way, but I wasn't sure how to go. So anyway, this one day, I thought, well, we were going to work on cooperation. I thought that's a good quality to learn. So we'd been having discussions on cooperation. I've been telling them stories about cooperation. And basically, it was zero results. Nobody was getting the handle of it. But anyway, so this one day it snowed. And snow around here is rare. And if you're a child, it's a cause for excitement. So the kids, there was probably about a dozen kids at this point. And they all wanted to go outside and play in the snow. And I said, okay, yeah, let's go out. And so we go in recess. We go out to play in the snow. Well, within 2 or 3 minutes, people were yelling at each other. They were throwing snowballs. They were rubbing each other's face in the snow. It was just chaos. And I said, this isn't working. So I called everybody back in. I said, okay, let's cool out. Sit still. Okay, take a deep breath. And I said, okay, we'll have to figure out what to do next. That didn't work. And they said, well, can we go back out? And I said, nope. I said, that's not. And then this little light came on. And I said, you know, we've been trying to learn about this idea of cooperation. I said, if anybody can take a pledge that when they go outside, they're going to cooperate, we'll go out and try it for a little while and see what happens. And so they were all, yes, yes, yes. So we went through this swearing-in ceremony. And I so-and-so pledged to cooperate if I go out to play. So we go outside, and at first it's extremely stilted. It's like, oh, here, can I give you some snow? Would you like some snow? And very stilted, but of course they're looking over their shoulder at me and say, can we keep going? But gradually they just started to settle in, and people just started to play. They started to play cooperatively, and I noticed that the architecture changed. But in the first recess, people were building forts and getting snowball stockpiles. And the second recess, they were building castles together. And So we came back in, but I went on for about 20 minutes, and we come back in, and I just said, well, which worked better? Which recess did you enjoy the most? Oh, the second one. Well, what was the difference? And they said, we cooperated. And I said, yeah. I said, that's the value. And so I wasn't even sure it was a great lesson at that point. It seemed to work. But so the word got back to Swami, and he called me over, and he was just so excited. It was like, finally, I'd done something. And it was just, but he just gave, you know, lots. He told that story many times. If you were here in the early days, you probably heard him tell the story. But it was just like he was validating something that had happened to give me the idea that this is experiential, that the sharing these things should be experiential. And that as the teachers picked up on that, things took off. We have a wonderful school system now today. I thought, since I was talking about Swami, I'd tell another little side story. So one of the things that Swami did encourage was, he said we should have dormitories or ashrams for the children. And he was partly based on his upbringing. He went to boarding school like when he was 9, and then he had some good experiences in England. So he thought we should do this. The Ranchi school was also a boarding school primarily. So I thought that made a lot of sense. And but it took a long time because there were very few buildings available here at that time. But finally, this one building came up. It was currently Benai's jewelry shop. So we came up, and I thought, okay, we have a space. And so I went to Swami, and I said, well, we finally got a space to try out this dormitory idea. And he says, oh, wonderful. He says, I have the perfect person to lead it. And I said, okay. I said, good. He said, who? And he said, Ram Leela. So now, if you're laughing, you have been here about 30 years. So my introduction to Ram Leela had been a few months or weeks earlier. We were having a Kriya meditation up at the meditation retreat, and it was just this incredibly beautiful, uplifting moment. We were all in the dome together in complete silence, and Swami was leading this Kriya meditation. And then as I'm sitting there, I become aware of this slightly irritating noise, and I kind of focused in on it. It sounded like a motor of some sort, which was unusual in those days up there. And so I thought, okay. But then the motors kept getting a little louder and a little louder. And I thought, wow, what is this? And finally, there's this run, 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 right outside the temple door. And you hear all of a sudden, he clicks off, and you hear these chains, crunch, crunch. And this person stomping into the temple, it throws open the doors, and this is the middle of a Kriya meditation, okay? And I watched Swami looked up, and he says, Ram Leela, welcome. And Ram Leela was a Hell's Angel at that point. And he had come complete, you know, thing. I was just completely blown away because at this point, this is the first story, because I was so impressed that Swami was so open that he just looked right through all the outer paraphernalia, and he saw the soul who was sincere spiritually. And he didn't care. He didn't care what the outside looked like. He just come right up. And I don't think Ram Leela took off his shoes and coming in the temple. Like, he just stomped up to the front of the room, and Swami gave him a Kriya blessing. And that was, you know, that was my introduction to Ram Leela. So anyway, so when he told me about this wonderful idea, who should be in charge of the boys at the village, I just kind of went, oh my God. So anyway, Ram Leela moves in. He moves in. First thing he sets up was his weights. You know, he has a huge weight paraphernalia, which actually turned out to be perfect for the boys. They just got into it. And the other thing is, he set out these two very tall speakers, sound speakers, and he pointed them in such a way so I think he liked to bounce the music across the valley from and hear the echo. And of course, various people in the community got upset with that. And I remember that was one of my jobs. I forget if it was Swami or Jyotish. Somebody said, you need to go talk to Ram Leela about his music. And so I got to go talk. But in getting to that, I found out he was this very sweet man. We would end up talking about Ananda Moy Ma, and he was just such a sweet devotee soul. But that was also, Swami was, you know, I don't know exactly what Swami was thinking, but my thought was, a couple of weeks later, this very, very seedy-looking guy shows up, and he hangs around for about a week or at least a couple of days. And somebody told me he was a delegate from the Hells Angels who didn't look kindly to people leaving the Hells Angels. And they were just checking us out to see if this was a valid move for Ram Lila. And the fact that he had all these little boys around him and he was sitting there in this middle of this place, eventually the guy left. I'd heard that somebody else told me, he said that he was an assassin. He had killed people who had tried to leave the Hells Angels. But anyway, I don't know if that's completely true or not, but it was part of the drama, the whole thing. But my bigger picture was just, in the school personally, was just learning to how that God, Divine Mother, Master looks after us. And there are so many different ways that I just saw. We didn't have any money, but things happened. Things just happened when they needed to. We didn't have a gymnasium for the first 10 years or longer, maybe it was 15 or 20 years actually. And so when you're trying to work with kids and there's no gymnasium, if it's the weather's fine, you go outside and play. But sometimes the weather wasn't fine. And we had this one winter where it just rained all the time. And the kids were at that point were at middle school, so like 11, 12, 13 years old. They had all this energy. And all we had was this little dinky little classroom. And they were just starting to lose it. And they couldn't blame them because they were 12 years old and they didn't have any place to go. So it was becoming a crisis. So this one day, I just said, we're going to have to talk about it tomorrow and we have to find a solution. And so next day that evening, a lady comes up to me as a visitor and says, can I come and observe the school? And I said, sure. I said, you can come in. I said, it's probably not going to be very pleasant because we're dealing with all this restless energy right now, but you can come in. So she came in that morning. She's sitting in the back of the room. And so I start this discussion about, okay, we got all this energy. What can we possibly do with it? So we're brainstorming and we're writing ideas on the board and stuff. And one of the ideas that pops up is somebody says, well, you know, it's raining here, but just a little ways up the hills, it's snowing. And we could go up and we could make a snow cave and we could, sleep in it or something. And I said, oh, that'd be a wonderful outlet for us. Because I have no idea what you should do with that. And therefore, we can't do it. But we wrote on the board. And then this lady in the back of the room, she raises her hand and she says, I can't be with you because I'm only here for a day. But she says, I'm probably one of the world's experts on snow caves and snow camping. And I can tell you everything you need to know. And so she comes up to the front of the room and she proceeds to tell us how you dig a cave at a certain angle so the heat doesn't escape and stuff. And we just all wrote it all down and we had this incredible adventure. We went out, we got up the snow a week later and we camped out for one or two nights, I can't remember which. But anyway, just took all that, we had solved our problem and it was just one of these things of just grace, just happening, just coming, popping in. It happened so many times in so many ways. I'll tell a story about, some of you know about the whistle. So I wrote this up for clarity. I called it the $500,000 whistle. So this is the second or third year, and we just moved up on what's now the Aspen building. And we didn't have a road there. There was an old, very rutted trailer, tractor road coming down from the top. And we never had a car up there. But one day the kids all come running in. They said, there's a car coming, a car. And I said, oh my God. Okay. So so we go out and it's not only a car, it's a car with a United States or California state government insignia on the top side of it. And the insignia says the fire marshal's department. And this very stern man gets out of his car and he's got his clipboard in his arm and he says, so you got a school here? And I says, yep, we got a school. And he says, do you know that you've got to have fire protection for a school? And I said, not particularly. And he said, yeah. He says, we have to be able to get a fire truck here in 10 minutes or less. Otherwise, you can't have a school here. I said, fire truck? And he says, yeah, you'd have to have a paved road. And I said, a paved road? I said, what do you think a paved road would cost? He said, oh, about $500,000 to get it from Tyler Foot Road. And he says, I'll be back in a month, and if you haven't made significant progress, we're closing the school down. And this is in the era when Seva told me I had $50 a month to run the school on, including my salary. So I thought, I have no, there's nothing I can do about this except offer it up. So to say, to give it to Master. Say, Master, if you want the school to continue, you have to do something. And so that's pretty much all we did. And we went back to doing what we could do with the school. So about, a month later, actually, we were starting to get a little nervous. And so a month later, here comes the car. I think it looked like the same car coming down this old rutted road, bouncing up and down. But I looked inside, and it doesn't look like the same man. And so the car door opens, and this guy looks out, and he smiles at me. That was a nice step forward. And it's a different man. And he says, "Hi, I've got this report here that I'm supposed to come out and see if you got adequate fire protection for your kids." And I said, "Oh, right. We tried our best." And he said, "Let's look around here." So he's got lots of space outside. Mainly what you have to do is, in the case you had a fire, is you get the kids outside. He said, "Do you have a whistle?" And I said, "No, but I said, we can afford a whistle." He says, "Good, here, sign here and get your whistle and we'll sign you off." And as he's getting in the car, I said, "What happened to the other guy?" And he said, "Oh, he decided he wanted to go work in arson investigation." And I said, "Oh, the guy's a much better job for him." So again, it was just one of those times where it just felt like, no, this is supposed to work. These schools are supposed to grow and expand. They have. Jumping ahead, it was about, let's see, when was it? About 1985 or so, the first branch school started in Palo Alto. And then the Portland school was shortly after that. And then the Seattle school came along. Then we have the two schools in Europe that come along, one in Assisi and one in Slovenia. And the whole idea that Master had brought, the idea of sharing life skills with children when they're young to prepare them to meet life's challenges, is such a needed thing on the planet today. In the beginning, Master called them how to live schools, and then SRF copyrighted that term, so we couldn't use that anymore. And then so we called just the Ananda schools, and then Swami came up with the idea of living wisdom schools relatively. It was like in the 90s sometime. So this whole idea of educating for life, educating to go prepare yourself to go out into the world ready to deal with challenges like, do you have courage to face your challenges? Do you have perseverance to follow through on what you need to do? Do you have the ability to choose happiness in situations rather than letting yourself get stuck in moods? And it goes on and on, but there's all these different, very incredibly practical things that can be shared with the kids. My, quote, kids now, my first set of kids are all turning 50 right about now. And it's been such a joy to watch them go out in their lives and just make good choices. This morning I went stop by the family camp that's happening right now. One of the young women that's helping out was a student here, and she was telling me, I said, "How's it going?" She says, "Well," she says, "I just had to make a big decision." She says, "I just had to stop working with this one person." And I said, "Why?" She says, "Well, I just realized they weren't completely honest. They were very had a little twist in the way they ran their lives." And she said, "I just realized that that's not how I want to run my life. I don't want to have my life be overseen by somebody like that." So she said, "I came up here and now I have the courage to step out and find another direction." And those are the kind of things that the kids can take with them. I never tried to, with the idea of trying to dogmatize them into a particular path. I always felt that that's part of their karma. If this is the karma to be in this path, they'll be fine. Otherwise, they'll find the path that's the best one for them. But everybody could learn these lessons and learn to apply them in whatever their karma was and make them the best of that. So that's what we get to do.
My name is Bharat. I came to Ananda in 1975. I had hitchhiked all the way across to Ohio, and I had in two rides, and I had spent 10 minutes waiting. And then when I was hitchhiking up to Ananda, I'd lived in Yuba City. I was outside the Nevada County Library, and I was there for 2 hours just waiting. And I thought, I'm coming to Ananda, and I'm having to wait. And then this green Volkswagen came and stopped, and there was this man in a beret. And I got in the car, and he said, I don't normally pick up hitchhikers, but I'm picking you up. And so I got in the car, and as we were riding along, this man started asking about my life. And this man was so joyful, and it was so thrilling to be in his presence that, unfortunately, I think for this man, I told him everything about my life and my dreams. And we were going on 49 and over the bridge, and then we came to Tylerfoot Road in the green Volkswagen. Him and I turned in, and we were going down the road. And finally, I looked at him, and I said, are you Swami Kriyananda? And he said, yes, I am. And that was my introduction to Swamiji. Before I came to Ananda, I had an incredible passion to help people to experience their own joy, their soul in nature. And I majored in how to find God in nature at university. And I was really fixated on that. But I wanted people to be able to really expand their consciousness and actually merge and go beyond their selves. But in the wilderness, I experienced this incredible stillness, and I realized that I had to learn meditation in order to really go deep into that. And I had been to Ananda in 1973 for a weekend, but for some reason it didn't stick, and I joined a Zen monastery up at Mount Shasta, and I was preparing to be a monk there. And then it was just very clear. Actually, it was a little bit more severe than Ananda. Everything was eating in silence, and there was one of the female nuns who had a bald head, and she was there, and very severe. And we were at the very back of the room, and we were finally, because I'd had to sit right next to her the whole time. We were the trainees, and finally, I was at the back of the room with my buddies, and we were eating spaghetti, and we just started laughing, and we just started spraying our spaghetti all over. And I just sort of realized I needed a place that was more joyful, and so I came to Ananda. As I said, I had a deep passion to work with people in nature, but I was coming to Ananda, and I set that aside because I wanted to, really be at Ananda. But I was, I remembered the joy that people experienced through the nature activities that I had created. And I asked a friend to write a book that included all of these activities. But he was too busy. He said he couldn't do it. So I felt like, well, I should write the book. And I didn't really know how to write, but I did my best. And Swami had just taught us, or me and everyone else, Spiritual New Week, the Om technique. And so I was practicing it 7 times a day. And while I was writing, and Ram Bhakta, an editor, lives now in Palo Alto, he said my writing was like wading through concrete. But how many How to Find God in Nature majors, have to write big papers? It's more of an intuitive experience. But I had people at Om is supposed to draw people at a distance to you. And so I drew friends to help me with a book. And Divine Mother stepped in, and she helped too. We didn't have much money at Ananda. As people have said, we didn't really have cars. And there was this renunciate who was actually a Baptist, and he would go to different Christian camps to build for them. And he helped build my shed so I could write Sharing Nature with Children, the book that I was going to write. And we were going to walk down to the market, and I had two pairs of shoes, my work shoes, and then some tennis shoes, but only two shoelaces. And so I took my shoelaces out of my work shoes, and I was putting them in my walking tennis shoes to go down to the market. And he looked at this process, and he said, "Isn't this taking poverty a little too far?" I could have afforded shoelaces at that time, but we didn't have cars, and we just, you know, made do with any way that we could. Well, Divine Mother was just blessing the whole process. I, you know, to self-publish a book and, you know, earning maybe $50 a month is a lot. But I just, you know, like I said, I had people kind of help me with the book. My job was just to try to put so much energy and magnetize as I could, because I just felt like it would really help people. And we found out there was a designer that lived in Camptonville, about 20 miles away from Ananda. He'd worked forgot his name now, Brower, is it David Brower, and Friends of the Earth. And he was a book designer, and Josh Gittimer. And so I'd hitchhike out to there, and we would talk about the book. And there was no oversight, really. I remember a publisher saying that you have to produce a book efficiently, because only one out of every 10 books ever pays for itself. But we didn't have that kind of oversight, and we could just make the book be whatever we wanted it to be. And when it was created, there was nothing like it, whether in content or in the design. And there was just an incredible enthusiasm for the book. And it was displayed in by Ananda Publications in Frankfurt. And there was a publisher there, the Exley Publications. Helen, she found the book, and she said, out of the 1 million books offered here at Frankfurt, I want to publish this book. And it was her and her husband that got the book spread throughout Europe and in Asia with foreign editions. And it created this incredible splash at the time. And we sold out the first edition very quickly. And then we needed a second printing. And Ananda, seeing the potential of the book, created a small team of people. Vimala Rogers was one of them, and Suresh. And they helped organize the programs, which I did. And they also, a little bit of fundraising, and they set up an appointment with this family in San Francisco, because Vimala wanted to print 50,000 copies, which we didn't quite print the second edition. But I was sent to San Francisco, and it was to the William Mattson Roth family. And he had just run for governor of California, which he lost to Governor Brown. But they, William Mattson, when his two sisters, the San Francisco Chronicle, said when they were launched into San Francisco society, they said it was like two luxury liners were launched into the ocean. That was sort of, they lived in Nob Hill. And so I was supposed to ask for $50,000 from them. And so I had to borrow, of course, the appropriate clothes at the monastery. And Nitai had the only size shoe that fit my feet, in size 9. But he was away doing a program. And so Ananta had a pair of shoes. And so Ananta, his shoes I got were size 13. Ananta's about 6'5", is that correct? So a little bit bigger than I am. And then, of course, you can't just wear shoes going to a place on Nob Hill. So I had to borrow a suit. Well, the only suit I could borrow was two sizes too small. So I had big feet and too small clothes. But I was pretty, you know, I looked like I was not very together, but I did put my shoes on just outside the house, and then I shuffled along in the shag carpet, and I didn't put my waist in my coat until just before going in, because my face just turned red, and that. But you know, the people are really known for their generosity, and they did give us $5,000, maybe because it looked like I needed it. But anyway, Divine Mother worked in a really beautiful way to make that happen. But I want to read you When I did it later in, maybe it was around 2000, I did a keynote presentation for the New England Environmental Education Association. And as an introduction, before my speech, this woman gave a little talk about what sharing nature with children meant to them. And I'd like to read a few of her words. It's pretty indicative of the splash that sharing nature had created when it came out. You know, at the time, it was just nature education was all intellectual-based, fact-driven. And they called it the walk, stop, and talk method, where you walk with a group, you stop, and you look at it, and you talk. It was all about something. And sharing nature helped people to just really have a direct experience of nature, where you actually expand your self-identity and really start to feel yourself in everything around you. And it was a real joyful approach. Well, this is what she wrote. Or what she said in the introduction. When a copy of Sharing Nature with Children landed in our midst, the teacher naturalists were like vultures competing for the kill. Most of us were new to environmental education. We had ecology textbooks and field guides, but little else besides what our hearts were guiding us to do. Here in this book, we found everything, philosophy, activities, ways to lead children to meaningful environmental education experiences. It was hugely significant for us. It was our guide and our compass. As you can imagine, it became challenging for 10 of us to share one copy of Sharing Nature with Children. It soon became difficult to locate, and due to its stature, it was easily concealed. Things got ugly. So finally, our director drilled a hole through one corner of the book, pulled a chain through it, and attached it to the wall of the staff bathroom. She figured that everyone would have equal access to it a few minutes a day. And around that time, I received a photo from a national park ranger who worked in the Redwoods, and he'd been to Patagonia near Terro del Fuego. And he had, as part of his training to the rangers, he did a little half-an-hour session of the Sharing Nature with Children activities. And the rangers were so taken in by it that he said that every spare moment they were like translating the book and sharing it with the others that couldn't read English. And it just, bit by bit, it just went all over the world. And in Japan, things started very quickly. And it spread throughout the whole country, so much so that it really became really very common part of the educational system. And the head of the elementary science curriculum talked to every science teacher in Japan through a presentation introducing a new curriculum and told the importance of having sharing nature-like experiences. And this, in September, I'm going over and for the 30th anniversary with the Sharing Nature group in Japan. And I'll be having a dialogue with this man. It'll be at Tokyo University and be filmed. And I'll be also doing a TED Talk and working with an outdoor products manufacturer who's putting his effort behind the launching of the Sky and Earth wellness activities. It just is really integrated into Japanese society, so much so that when I was there, it was the late 80s, and I was in my hotel room after a busy day of things, and I like to watch a little bit of Japanese baseball for a few minutes because they're so rabid the way that they root. And so I was watching just a couple innings of the game. And there was a break in between, and there was a commercial, and I'd heard about this commercial, but I hadn't seen it yet. And a producer wanted to make a commercial around one of the Sharing Nature activities. And so I actually saw it on national TV. And it was, to set the scene, there was a man of great nature, a Japanese, dressed in a Suwak Indian headdress like this in the rainforest in New Zealand. And he was doing the bird calling activity that you can make a sound to draw birds to you. And he was going, psh, 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 psh. And then they had these trained white doves come and land on the stick that he was holding. And then they broke into this energy drink. So, you know, sometimes you just put out the energy and... You don't control the energy. Swami and Master, they both set the example for us in terms of taking these priceless teachings that we have. And, you know, they brought such clarity, and there's such depth, and they're so revolutionary people's lives. And they've adapted them to things like education, leadership, business, all different aspects of life. Swami was sitting at a table. It was a crystal clarity tea for all the books. And Swami just quietly said he would like to see in the future Ananda to be a place of ideas. Where all of us are so blessed with exposure to these teachings and the magnetism to practice these teachings with each other. And Ananda just isn't for all of us here at the village. That was something that Swami taught us right away. Ananda is really for the whole world. There's so many people that are part of Ananda just by knowing that it exists. They come here, or just the idea that there's a place like this. So many of the Japanese leaders to progress and to be more of an intermediate or advanced leader, they had to come to Ananda and experience Ananda and then take a sharing nature program and also learn about the schools. And when Ananda and I go back to Japan, so many people we hadn't seen maybe for some years, they'll come up, "Do you remember us? We went to Ananda. Ananda's our spiritual home." And everybody says that. And we know how the impact of Ananda has been for people. And I guess whenever I would hear a spiritual principle, I'd get so excited about it. Like Swami would talk about, in order to be able to attune yourself to something else and feel a sense of communion to relate from your center to its center, you know, essentially from your life force to its life force. And that's when you really feel a sense of unity. Well, I would hear a principle like that, and I would want to share it. And not just with a few people, I wanted to share it with the whole world. And so I would pray. I'd walk in the forest, and I would just pray to Divine Mother, show me a way, a method that would help people experience this, where they didn't have to buy into the whole philosophy. Maybe they weren't ready to be a yogi. Yogis, Kriya yogis especially, are aware of the energy in the spine, but not everybody is. But show me a way. And Divine Mother, every activity came as an answer to a prayer to Divine Mother. And so, like an activity, I'm the Mountain came. And people feel this incredible sense of communion just instantly. One man who walks the Pacific Coast Trail, the Appalachian Trail every year, said that in 4 minutes, I get into a place doing that exercise that takes me a month in the wilderness to get to. That's a big statement to make. Everybody's hyping things. But we all know the value of interiorization. And so what sharing nature has gone, you know, millions of people use it. And it's, you know, it's integrated into, like, in the religious studies program, the national curriculum in England. They chose the 5 major religions. And then, you know, Christianity and Hinduism, Buddhism and Islam. And they had a major part of that presentation was an active component where you could actually do things to experience the principles of the religion. Well, one of the religions was the indigenous cultures and Celtic. And sharing nature was the focus for that. So we sort of made it as one of the 5 major religions. But it's because it gave people an actual experience. And isn't that what Master said, is that our religion is self-realization? And so Master also said that there's no reason why we can't teach religion in schools. And if we can't teach, and you don't want to teach the scriptures, the dogma, but when you help people to feel the qualities of God, peace, joy, light, wisdom, that's an actual divine experience. And I remember leading the tree imagery, and it was in 18, 1986, and the 14th floor of a hotel in Albuquerque. And it's where people extend their roots and their branches, and they become bigger than they are. And they interact with life around them. They're expanding their sense of identity. And then they withdraw their life into their self in the winter, and it's like that process of yoga, of meditation. And he's lying down, and afterwards, this Catholic priest said, it's the calmest I've ever felt in my life. And I remember Nitai telling me in Vedic times that to train the children, they would maybe be beating a drum, and the children have to listen to the beat of the drum, or how many times a person twirled around with that ribbon, just to develop concentration. Well, sharing nature activities like a meditation, where it helps people to really experience through their senses in a way that's concentrated, and where they get so absorbed they lose consciousness of their individual self. And it's a movement towards that and a sense of self-forgetfulness. And then that's when we really know things. And so what it does is it opens doors for people and then allows them to go through that door and then pursue it and maybe cultivate a discipline that can really bring that experience to them, maybe through meditation or that. I say I better be careful how long I talk. So anyway, thank you and bless you all.
Stand up for a few minutes or 1 minute and stretch. Be a mountain or a tree. Thank you all. Okay. My name is Durga. I came to Ananda in 1974 with my husband, Vidura, and our two children. Missy was 6, Dwayne was 9. They were in Nitai's class. Actually, Maitri was also one of their teachers. And they were in a one-room schoolhouse with children from 5 to 12 years old. And these people did amazing things with those kids. And they both went on to go to college and have wonderful careers. So we're very blessed. And even they are very grateful that they grew up here. So it's a real testament to both the community and Nitai and Maitri. So my topics are two, and I'll try to fit them in my 15-minute slot. The first one is Ocean Song. So in around 1979, the couple Maria and Peter Myers came to Swami Kriyananda, and they said that they had some land and they would like to share it with Ananda. Would Ananda like to go there and start a community? Swamiji said yes. And I don't know exactly the timing, but in our lives at that time, our personal lives, Vidura was trying to figure out what our next steps were. He had been working outside of Ananda so that our family could be here because, as you've heard, there was no money. And so he was working outside. He had he had conquered sort of the worldly, learning how to make money, putting out energy, was very successful in his job. And he was able to continue that even when we lived here. But he had sort of realized he knew how to do that. And he was in his comfort zone, as he says. And so he went to Swamiji and he sort of said to me, you know, I don't know what Swami's going to say. We might end up leaving Ananda. I'm not sure what's going to happen. I said, okay. So he went down. I say down because he was in the dome at Ayodhya. And he went to talk to Swami, and I fully expected him to come back and we were going to move. But instead, Vidura walked up and said, well, it looks like we're the new managers of a new community called Ocean Song. And we have to move. But that's where we're moving. And so our children were in middle school, high school. I think Dwayne was a senior. And he didn't want to move, obviously. He wanted to finish out his schooling here. So Melissa and Vidura and I went to Ocean Song, and there was nothing there at that time. It was brand new, except Peter Maria had a beautiful, beautiful land. It was 900 acres. On a clear day, you could see the ocean. It was 5 miles from the ocean. It was on Coleman Valley Road. Some of you know that road. And just really beautiful. And they had really nice cows, Arjuna, very nice cows. And they had beautiful gardens. And that's what was there. And they had their house. And there was a little tiny house, I think, that had been built years before. But nothing to house all the people that were going to come. When we were there, when we left, there were about 30 people that ran the community. I know Savitri and Sudarshan came after us, and they really took it out. And we're sort of the starting energy of things, it seems. So we went there, and we were looking for housing for people and trying to make things nice and projects. That's what we do. So we found this place nearby that built yurts, canvas yurts. I don't know if they make them anymore, but now they're vinyl. But anyway, there was a canvas yurt, and this woman named Yuri had a yurt business. And so we built these beautiful decks, really nice redwood decks, and we put the canvas yurts on them. And I think we built about five. And it was Roy and Paula, and it was us, Karuna and Shoshona, Trimurti and his first wife, Sita, were there, Michael and Ann, a lot of people that you know. Raghu was there, and Ray Noble, we put in charge of the apprentice program. So I have this vision of Ray under a tree. He had one person, and he was teaching him the teachings. And I always remember that, such a special moment, because it was so sweet. And but anyway, so we built these wonderful yurts, and they had this great water protection that was built into them. And then at one point, about a year later, somebody said, you know, you should really put some fire protection on there, because, you know, fires could come, and it was dry, and so, okay, we'll put fire protection on. So we did that. And then I remember when Roy and Paula moved there, Vidura was showing him our yurt. And he said, and up here we have this, and his finger went right through the canvas. And we found out later that the water protection and the fire protection created an acid, and so those didn't last very long. But we also built a temple. We had a temple year. We had a school. Shoshona had a really nice school there. We had quite a few children that came. So it was starting to be built. And Vidura was there sometimes. He, again, still worked outside to help make it happen for us. What else I want to say about Ocean Song? Well, Savitri and Sudarshan came after us, and they were there 3 or 4 years, I think, and really created something beautiful there. Maybe next year they can talk more about it. But they would go out into the surrounding cities, and they would do classes every night. That we had a little bed and breakfast in that little house that Paula created, a beautiful little bed and breakfast. It was filled every weekend. We just had a lot of energy. Devashi was there. He ran the gardens. Dayanand was there. He ran the dairy. And it was like this beautiful community, beautiful family that we all shared there. Then it was like 1980. We were there for about 1.5 or 2 years. And then we came back, and we were asked to go to the retreat, the meditation retreat, which is where we started. Now we're returning 10 years later. And I was there with Leela. And she and I were in the office. Those of you who don't know Leela, she passed away a few years ago. She was a Swamiji's cook and very dear friend for many, many years. She traveled all over the world with him. She was a very good friend of many of us. And she and I ran the office up there. The one story I love to tell about the meditation retreat at that time, before it moved down to here, is that it wasn't like it is now. It had a Kali Lodge, which was it was built there, so I'm sure at one time it was very nice, but it wasn't very nice then. And then we had tents on these platforms, but the platforms had these big holes in them. So we would always tell people, be careful when you walk, you know, not to fall in the holes, because they were big. And so one night, this man arrived. And at that point, I don't think we had phones still. I'm not sure when we got the phones up there, but we did. So our reservations would come with a note saying there's a man coming. So, and sometimes they got there and sometimes they didn't. And so we were waiting for this man to come. So this man arrived and he's in a suit and he had on those shiny black shoes that have the little points, and he was very well dressed. And so he arrived and we sort of went, oh my gosh, because he was staying in one of the tents. So I don't know if it was, I think it was myself that led him out there, and we had to give him a flashlight, and there's no lights there. And so we took him out. We said, be really careful of the holes. And we felt sort of bad, but he wasn't there the next morning. It took a certain kind of person to come to Ananda in those days. And he just couldn't. I mean, I've always felt badly for him. I think I pray for him every once in a while. But anyway, so then in about, so we had started, I think, somebody's going to correct me on this, I'm sure, but I believe in August of 79, we had our very first Sunday service here. So Arjuna Lucky, who now is in Assisi, created the plan for these buildings. And it was so sweet. I remember Swami coming out and digging the first hole and just was so happy because here the vision, it's starting to happen more. And it just like what Jyotish said, it's the expansion time. So not only in the world, the world is expanding from, I looked this up last night, 86 cents for gas, but $50,000 for a house, $17,000 annual income. So everything is starting to expand beyond that. A brand new car was $3,500. And so it's just everything's expanding and women's rights are coming in. And there's Jupiter. We're landing, or not landing on Jupiter, but going to Jupiter. And Jupiter's the guru planet. So you just see it's going to happen. And Swami's right in there. Vidura was, Gyan Devi, you don't know Gyan Devi, most of you, but she was this wonderful lady that used to live here, and she's still living up in Portland. And she wrote a beautiful book called Good Morning, Great Souls. And Nishala wrote a book at the same time, and they were both about, they went around and interviewed people that had been here and their experiences, how they came here, why they came here, what happened when they came here. And I was reading that this morning. I was reading Vidura's chapter. And Vidura was talking about being in the comfort zone. And he went out to work because he could do that. And he was providing for his family because he could do that. And everything was just fine. And then the day before Spiritual Renewal Week happened one year, Swami called him and asked him if he would give one of the talks. He said he never knew what pain was until that moment. And I remember walking into our bedroom, and he was back. I think he would be fine if I told this. He was back in the corner. He just looked like, you know, a deer in headlights. And he took it. He did it. He went up there, and it was a really fun talk. And he told about a dream and Purushottama and blah, blah, blah. And then you still hear people say, I remember that talk Vidura gave. So it was all, Swami was constantly taking you out of the comfort zone and putting you in to what was your next step. And so all these things that we did reflect that, you know, can you do this? Can you do this? And he was amazing that way. He just knew what was yours to do next. So we came down to the expanding light. So Leela and I were up Oh, no, I want to tell you one story. So we would come down here for Sunday service. We would cook all the meals up at the meditation retreat. We put them in, what do you call those? Coffins. Bad name. We would put them in these coffins that you put food in. And we would bring them down in a big truck. It was a blue truck. Bring them down here. We'd set up sawhorses and plywood, and we'd serve the meal, and everybody would eat, and then we'd pile all the dishes back in, take them up to the meditation retreat, and wash them. So that happened year after year. In the summertime, we would do that. In the winter, we would have services up there. So then it wasn't until 1984 we got the word, Leela and I, that it was time to come down here. We were going to move everything, the retreat, as it was at that time down here. So I remember us walking around, mostly in the temple, because there wasn't a lot else there. There were three domes, the common dome, the temple, and the kitchen. And we went around, and we had to decide, what are we going to take down there, and what are we going to leave up here? So I remember that as being a very special moment. And then we brought it down here. And just to tell you what was here at that time, 1984, we had these three buildings that were not finished. This was always going to be just a classroom. It was built as a classroom because the temple was going to be built over there soon. And it will be. It will be, because it's in the ether. It's not going to be gone. So the temple's over there. Just see it in your mind. And then we had the dining room and the kitchen. And then we didn't have the money for real housing, but we built the five cabins. Vidura and I built those cabins, and the one on the end burned down about 10 years ago, and they were named after the five Pandava brothers. And we had that, and we had tents, and that was it. And then I think, Prakash, we had the building still down there. Yes, I think so. Prentice Village was still down the hill in 1984, and so we had people staying down there. And so we had that. And then we didn't have an office, so we bought a trailer. And Leela, and I think Sudarshan also is here, maybe maintenance or something. But I remember you being in that trailer. And Leela and I, and then, And then we had the shower house was only for the women. The men, we bought another trailer. And this was a trailer, really, really not nice. It had like in the movies, you know, you see all the showers lined up and all the men are taking showers. I never went in there to clean that place. We had other people to do that. But that was our shower for the guys. And, you know, I said to Davey just now, how did people ever stay here? But we did. And, so then later we built that, but we had tents and we had that. And then Vidura said his only job as manager of this expanding light was to move chairs. Because he said, when you move chairs, you know what's happening and you know what event's taking place. And at that time, we didn't have anybody paid to teach. Shivani did Healing Heart, Healing Mind. I guess you were in San Francisco. Asha did month-long programs. Prakash did programs. There were probably, Savitri, you must have been teaching then too. So we had teachers, but nobody got paid. I think maybe Nityananda, you might try that. It worked. So anyway, but it all worked. I mean, everyone worked here, so they just left their job for a month or so, and we made it work that way. And it was a very joyful time. When the singers were singing, I was thinking, the battles we fight, the victories we win are never the victories we know. I was thinking about that. We never know. I mean, Swami would ask you to do something. You never really knew why. But you found out later on, and they were always victories. If you said yes, you always found that in the future. So anyway, the expanding light, look how beautiful it is. What a wonderful name. It even reflects what we're talking about today, this expansion. So expanding light, God bless.
Okay. Well, there's not much time left, but I wouldn't have missed one moment of what our speakers shared. And first, I want to thank all of my friends who spoke this morning, that not only for what you said, but your lives and what we have done in building Ananda. It was fun. It was crazy. But what Swami gave us from the very first moment was the art of the possible. And you looked at how can any of this happen, but it did happen. And we never knew how, but it always did happen. Because what Swami lived and what he trained us in and taught us was, just as Master said, when someone asked him, what are the resources of this organization? And he said, none, God alone. And that's what we lived on, and that's what worked. And how did people come here? Why did they stay? We were recently up in Seattle, and I had a 3-minute conversation with a good friend up there, Navriti, who told me a brief story that had a very profound effect on me, and it's all of our story. She said she was 6 years old, living in Minnesota. Her parents were Lutherans, never heard of yoga, autobiography, Paramahansa Yogananda. Then one day, and it happened to be March 7th, 1952, her mother said, oh, look, it was probably the next day, there's an article in the paper, some Swami, Paramahansa Yogananda, died. And Navriti said her sister was sitting there. Her sister has no memory of that. But when Navriti heard that, the shockwave went through her, and she knew that was her, what her destiny was. So for each one of us, there was that moment, whether remembered or not, where we said, I don't care if I don't have money. I don't care if this is impossible. I don't care if I don't know how to do this. I don't care if the world is telling us that we're terrible and foolish. I don't care about any of that, because I heard that call, Krishna's flute. I heard it high on a cloud. All else I've left aside. And Swami gave us the art of the possible. And as Ananda moves forward into the future, I hope we never lose that courage and that faith in God to say, as my dear little friend Frodo Baggins said, I will go forward, though I do not know the way. And this is what we do. We just go forward. We don't always know where it's going to be. Swami, or Jyotish, was speaking of the start of San Francisco and the outreach. It started with Swami doing the Superconscious Living seminars in the Palace of Fine Arts in San Francisco. Huge hall, 1,500 people. We almost filled it. That was when Swamiji asked, Jyotish had been teaching. I hadn't really been teaching much at all. The night before the program, he said, I'd like you to do part of the presentation. And the art of the possible, I just thought, there's no way I can do this. This is impossible. As they say in Italian, that Swami, it irked him when he first went, ma, è difficile, but it's difficult. It's all difficult. It's all impossible, but we do it through God's grace. And I remember getting up there just feeling Swami holding me up on a cloud of grace. And I was, by the time I got to the stage, my hands had stopped shaking, my knees had stopped shaking, and I don't know what I said, but it happened. But, and then I remember also during that time, and we were putting on a performance of The Jewel and the Lotus, which we'll be doing it this year at Spiritual Renewal Week. If you haven't seen the play, it's a wonderful play that Swamiji wrote. And Jyotish was in it, I was in it, Swami was the storyteller. And we were all in Indian, I played Kanta, and I was in an Indian sari, and lots of Indian jewelry and makeup and everything. We all were in stage makeup and Indian clothes. We finished the play, Swami said, let's go out for an Indian dinner. And we said, okay, we'll change our clothes. No, you don't need to change your clothes. We're all going out. And so, again, I didn't know why that happened, but we were so much in a bhav of India that I think, again, he was planting seeds that we'd be spending a lot of time in India. I got to the restaurant, and honestly, I looked at the people and I thought, Westerners. These must be Westerners. And I must say they looked awfully pale. And just their clothes were so drab and uncolorful. But it was like he took us into that other incarnation. And so when we go to India now, it feels so much like home, maybe more so than the West. But it was always riding on that wave. Nothing is impossible. And, you know, sort of one of the underlying themes that people have said over the years, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. And that's the story of Ananda. If it were easy, it wouldn't be what it is today. A few years ago, someone was visiting, and you know, when we would show people around, we would just say, you know, and this person said, oh, I thought it would be bigger. And I was just sort of, I paused and I thought about that. And I thought, you should have seen what God had it all to himself. There was nothing, absolutely nothing. An abandoned pig farm is what it was, with a couple of sheds and outbuildings. And everything you see has been built by people who live here, who love Master, who wanted to just create the possible out of the impossible. And I'm so glad that young people are coming to continue this great experiment. Don't ever get discouraged. It all will work out. It always has. The community, you know, when the fire hit, and we won't, that was last time, but I'll just close with this little thing. You know, everything burnt to the ground. We went to the ashes a few days later when the ground cooled to where our house had been. The cast iron stove had melted, if you can imagine. We had a jar of coins. They had melted. There was just a little pool of metal. But you know what survived the fire in that house? Swami had given us for our wedding two little very delicate white porcelain cups with little birds painted on them. And when we were clearing out the ashes, there were those two little cups that survived. And we still have them in a sacred box. But that's what survives. The rest all gets taken away. But the divine love that went into the creation of this place, that's what is the bedrock of what Ananda is. And you see it in these great souls that have been speaking this morning and who are sitting amongst you. So I think all of us feel we give you Ananda. Swami gave it to us, Master gave it to him. Not like we're going, but it's up for all of you, all of us, to carry it forward now in that same spirit of anything is possible. Nothing is difficult if we know that the wind in our sails is our guru and the boat is made of Master's dream.